Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the first week of March 2010. I'm Alex Kratosky, and let there be springtime. This week we're getting the reaction from the creators of the Opera browser about Microsoft's decision to offer a piece of its Internet Explorer market share to the browser development community. And we're talking to two entrepreneurs who are hoping to help new media startups find their footing as the co-working phenomenon sweeps the British Isles. Joining me this week is Bobby Johnson, our man on the streets of Silicon Valley, who's coming to us down the line, and Elizabeth Varley, former director of digital editorial consultancy firm Online Content UK and co-founder of TechHub. This week, Google found itself defending internet freedom after three of its top brass were convicted for allowing a video to be uploaded showing an autistic teenager attacked by bullies. The video was uploaded onto Google Video in 2006, which was before the internet giant acquired the video sharing site YouTube.
We are going to appeal this decision because we believe that it poses a crucial question for the freedom on which the internet is built. None of these three employees had anything to do with this video. They didn't upload it. They didn't film it. They didn't review it. And yet they have been found guilty. And so if this is let to stand, we believe that it would threaten the very freedom that the internet has brought about.
That was Bill Etchickson, Google's senior communications manager. Bobby, does it actually threaten internet freedom, as Etchickson says, and online privacy? Or is this a deflection away from the company's need to, and I'm quoting Charles Arthur here, to put its house in order, as Charles posited today on the technology blog?
Well, I think the crucial thing here is what's known in British law as the mere conduit defence, i.e. that your internet platform, your website, is open and lets people kind of do things on it, and that you can't necessarily control what they do. Now, that's an argument lots of internet companies make, Google among them, saying, you know, we make the tools, we can't control what people do. We try, but we can't regulate everything. YouTube's a good example. I mean, 20 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute of the day. So, you know, they say, you know, imagine how hard it would be to screen all that and to regulate it. The opposite side of things is it doesn't matter. If you build a platform that enables people to bully each other or to commit criminal acts, then you should bear some responsibility. The Italian court obviously here thinks that Google should and gave three executives, as we heard, 6 months suspended sentences. To me, I think the big issue here is simply with YouTube in a lot of ways and the way Google manages communities. It's very bad at it. YouTube often feels like just a venue for abuse, if you read the comments.
Just don't read the comments, I think, is the
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, that's something that a lot of people have pointed out. And you can sort of crowdsource that regulation if you're good. But actually, one of our commenters, Banana on Toast, said it just isn't working. Because this particular video we're talking about was up for 2 months and was only actually taken down when the police approached YouTube. So you can see it doesn't, sometimes that stuff doesn't work. So you can argue that you're a platform, but that doesn't necessarily absolve you of responsibility.
There are a lot of really interesting issues that you bring up here, including this idea that, you know, YouTube doesn't know how to do community. The idea that this was tried in Italy as opposed to somewhere else. So now we've got, you know, international regulations that are coming into play. Elizabeth, how do you think that this outcome in Italy is going to affect video regulations internationally and user-generated content in general?
This is not just an issue for one country. When you're accessing services globally, it's very difficult to ensure that the same law can apply across borders, across countries, across platforms even. And I think it's likely to lead to a lot more stringent user terms and conditions, perhaps. I very much take Bobby's point about the communities element. There are so many sites where self-policing by users works incredibly well, where images are flagged, where videos are flagged. And I think if you don't have that sense of community there, then the users aren't trying to protect each other. It's really only about what they can get out of it at that moment.
Very interesting, this idea of crowdsourcing these regulations. I can imagine that that would make many a country a little bit twitchy. But also out this week, Twitter announced that it will serve up relevant ads of 140 characters or less in its search facility based on keywords that appear in an account holder's Twitter stream. Now, although the company, which receives, Bobby, I think you reported this week, 50 million messages from its users each day, Twitter has eschewed charging for its service. It has been posited that this model will help to fill the coffers of its founders, who have, to date, been working without a money-making business plan. Bobby, the details of this advertising deal, the whole model, is a little bit hazy. What do you actually know about what's going on behind the scenes?
Well, essentially, they've been working on this for quite a while now, and looking at different ways to make money out of Twitter. We've already seen some ways that they're cashing in, and that's essentially by making deals with companies like Google and Microsoft to allow them access to all of the information so they can index it for their search engines. And what we're seeing now is they're starting to talk to other companies. They're starting to sort of roll out the idea, if not the actual system itself. I mean, essentially, you know, it's quite a lot like Google and the way they monetize search by chucking in ads that people can bid on. Not a great surprise that Twitter's taking the most successful internet advertising mechanism in history and copying it.
Indeed, as many have. And Elizabeth, people don't seem to be that bothered about Google ads. How do you think people will respond to advertising going through a search facility for Twitter?
I think as long as it's not intrusive, users will feel comfortable with it. I think where it can become intrusive is as we've seen people complaining about user-targeted ads on Facebook, for example, where a user of the service feels very much targeted. They feel that their private information is being used, very much exploited for commercial gain in ways that they may not be so comfortable with. And I think if Twitter is using a model where they're using keywords, with Twitter being such a personal communication mechanism for so many people, there might be people that are a little uncomfortable with that.
I have to say, I did sense the death knell of Twitter earlier today when I was searching for stories and saw that Sony PR has announced that it believes that £1 million of its revenue has come in from Twitter. So I think that, you know, it is a viable marketing and PR tool. Enter the death of Twitter. But that's just my personal thoughts. Finally, this week, Microsoft announced that it will be offering its users a choice in internet browsers the next time its operating system is updated. The software giant, notoriously hauled up in the European Commission for allegedly breaching monopoly laws with its Internet Explorer browser in 2008, will display a screen with Internet Explorer, Firefox, Google's Chrome, Opera, and Safari, allowing users a one-time-only opportunity to select the application that they use to access the web. Now, this represents a real win for the creators of the Opera browser, who initially brought the case to the European Commission, and who are currently the underdog in the browser wars. Charles Arthur spoke with John von Techner, the co-founder of Opera, and began by asking him if he expects the choice to have an effect on the number of people who use other services than Internet Explorer.
I think it's very clear that when people are offered a choice of browsers, and a fair amount of people will choose to use another browser, I think the choices that are there, I think most people agree that most all of them are an upgrade to the browser that's included with the Windows. So I think you'll see a fair amount of people trying out different browsers and shifting, and we're hoping a lot of people will choose Opera. We think there's many reasons why they should.
You were the company which originally complained to the European Commission about Internet Explorer. What was the basis of your complaint? What was it that you said was not right?
Microsoft managed through the bundling of Internet Explorer with Windows to basically kill off Netscape and most of the competition in the market. I think the web is too important to be controlled by one company. So we think it's important to have choice. And there is actually regulation that says that what Microsoft did is illegal.
In the US, the Justice Department took Microsoft to court over pretty much this subject, over the tying of Internet Explorer into Windows. And there was a very big lawsuit there, which didn't quite disentangle Internet Explorer from Windows. And yet, at around that sort of time, and following on from that lawsuit, the number of different browsers that people were using suddenly started growing. Firefox, in particular, started really taking off. Why do you think it was that Firefox, which is a sort of descendant of Netscape, why do you think that took off and Opera didn't at the same time?
The case between Microsoft and the Justice Department in the US, this was being done with the Clinton administration. And as you say, they were giving Microsoft a really, really, really hard time. That changed when there was a change of presidency in the US. And the case was very quickly settled. Firefox started to take off in 2004. So the Mozilla Foundation actually had been working on the browser since 1998. Right. It's only in 2004 that they started to see growth. I think you just have to hand it to them. They did a great work at marketing. They built a good product, so they managed to get a fair amount of users.
But why do you think it was that Firefox and Mozilla was so effective and Opera wasn't able to take advantage of what must have clearly been an interest among people in getting a different browser?
Well, I think at the time, I mean, we had a different business model. I think it's
you were paid for.
Yes. I mean, we didn't really have a way to give away the browser. Mozilla had a way to give away the browser, and they provided a good browser, and they did a good marketing effort with the browser. So they got a fair amount of users. We only changed our business model a year later, and since then we've been adding users at a nice pace. But I think we can get a lot more now.
When one looks at the browser statistics, Opera is only counting for a few percent of share. Why then is that? Why is it such a small number?
100 million users is 100 million users. Mm. And it's 100 million.
But there's hundreds and hundreds of millions out there.
Clearly, we are a company with less means than some of our competitors. Distribution-wise, it's word of mouth. So the fact that we are having close to 1 million downloads per day of our browsers through word of mouth, to me, is actually something I'm pretty happy with.
What is your business model now, then, if you're giving it away for free?
So the business model is we are working with companies like Google, Yahoo, Amazon, and the like. So we try to choose partners that are relevant to our users. And we put those partners in good locations in the browser. So we introduced the search field in the browser in 2001, the first to do so. They use that. We get a cut. It's a win-win.
And are you satisfied with the resolution that the European Commission has come up with this browser choice?
Yeah, it's a good solution. I mean, you can always discuss could it be better this way or better that way. But I think you have to commend the Commission for the task they've done. I mean, you have to remember, this is a fairly small group of people that is working on this in the Commission. And they're taking on a large company in Microsoft. And they've fought, I believe, for the consumers and for choice and for the internet. And they've come up with a solution together with Microsoft, which allows people to see different browsers, to try out different browsers. And I think that's great.
Even if Opera doesn't benefit in terms of the number of people who sort of come to you through the browser screen, you know, the ballot screen process, what do you think is the benefit to the wider web of this, the ballot screen?
I think what is important is to ensure that there is a choice of browsers. We don't want a situation. I mean, we saw that, what happened with Microsoft and with IE when they thought they had basically killed off all competition, when they had killed off Netscape. There was no progress. There was no, I mean, IE 6 is still around. I mean, it's a very, very, very old browser. I think even Microsoft wants people to switch now. Mm. And that shows you what happens when you have a monopoly situation. There is no reason to innovate. There is no reason to come out with new versions. And things become stale.
What is Opera doing in the mobile space?
So in the mobile space, we are number one. We provide our browser on just about any mobile phone out there. And that's unique. I mean, we have a browser that runs on just about any mobile phone. We're adding about 5 million users per month now, net. So this is active users during the month. So from one month to another, we're adding 5 million. We actually even showcased an iPhone version of Opera Mini at the World Mobile Congress in Barcelona.
Has that been accepted? Is Apple?
We haven't
that?
Posted it yet, so we've just been showing it around.
That is, you haven't submitted it to Apple to see if they'll approve it for sale.
I haven't done it yet.
Are you going to?
Yes.
And if Apple were to turn it down, as it has turned down a number of other products that it thinks competes with things it already does on the iPhone, what would you do then? Would you complain, for example, to...
No, I mean, Apple doesn't have a monopoly in the mobile market. There's nothing to complain about. Right. Obviously, we would be unhappy if they weren't not to allow it, but I don't really see any reason why they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't anyone like to see great products available on their platforms? I see no reason why Apple shouldn't allow it.
That was Charles Arthur speaking with John von Techner from Opera on their triumph at the European Commission and the possibility of a new legion of new users taking up their browser services. Now, Elizabeth, I want to turn to you first, just for your comments on this interview. How likely do you think it is that people will break from the pack, that they will decide, oh, I don't know, I'll just go for Opera when that little sign comes up?
I think it very much depends on the type of user that we're talking about. I think your average user of Windows, if they're not particularly technically minded, may feel, oh, I know IE, I've used IE, that's what I'm familiar with, I don't really want to change. On the other hand, I think if they've felt frustration with the browser, even if they're not such technical people, they may think, well, maybe it's time to try something different. And I think even the average user knows about Microsoft and the issues of monopoly that they've faced. And so I think there may just be a sense of wanting to break away from that. So I think there is a good opportunity here for other browsers.
Well, somebody in the Twitterverse actually said that echoed your thoughts. For people who haven't been frustrated by IE. Zantiak says most people will click to stay with IE because we are lazy. Bobby, can you just quickly run through the benefits of the different browsers?
I think actually what we've seen, although there's a lot of competition in the browser market, there isn't actually a huge difference between the browsers these days. Internet Explorer has upped its game. Firefox has probably become slightly less innovative. And then you've got Chrome from Google, and Apple Safari and all of these guys. But actually, although there are differences under the hood in the rendering engines they use and certain things to make them faster or slower or more configurable, actually, you know, the browser experience is fairly stable at the moment. This is one of the questions that I wonder about, really, is when people see the ballot screen come up, how can you explain the benefits of using different things to different people? And offer them a choice that may be IE or maybe something else. And even if you do offer them that choice, if I look at it and I say, oh, look, there's Maxthon. How the hell am I going to know what Maxthon does? How do I know if I import my bookmarks, will it work? How do I know all of the little pieces of the puzzle that I need in order to make an informed decision? And on top of that, if I just see a logo for Google or Apple, you know, the big names, is it just going to end up with more people downloading Chrome because they know who Google are? I just wanted to also point out that it's really confusing to people to see this screen pop up and slightly disturbing. One commenter on the blog, Britpunk, said his girlfriend, who's fairly computer literate but just didn't know that this was coming, got the browser screen, pop-up came up, and she was worried, he said, that she thought she'd possibly gained some sort of malware on her computer that was hijacking the browser, and that it's a lovely way to panic users. And I think that's really part of the problem here, is that the people you're targeting this at are the people who didn't realise they had a choice, and they're exactly the kind of people who aren't going to be able to make the choice even if you offer it to them in this way. So, you know, I think the European Commission has tried to do a good job, but we've really got to see how the numbers play out and whether it makes any difference whatsoever.
Well, you can read up on all these stories, and I'm sure Charles Arthur will have the numbers in the future. And of course, all the rest that's pinging around the web at guardian.co.uk/technology. All across the UK, lonely technology freelancers are leaving their warm coffee shops and their bedrooms and are gathering together in co-working offices, their new homes away from home. The movement, which started in Silicon Valley outside San Francisco, has found a willing church of volunteers eager to connect with like-minded idealists and entrepreneurs. As VictSP on our Twitter stream says, freelancing is still isolating. What the people who are taking part in this experiment are discovering is that co-working engenders a strong community, local knowledge, and business collaboration. Mark my words, the next generation of Googles, Amazons, and Facebooks will be born out of places called Core, Tech Hub, and Citizen Space. Joining me to discuss this trend are the founders of Core and Tech Hub. Andy McMillan founded Core and Elizabeth Varley co-founded Tech Hub. Andy, in 30 seconds, tell me what Core is. And I am timing you, so keep to time, please.
Core is the co-working space in Belfast. It's basically an open plan working space, and it's full of like programmers, designers, developers. There's actually a product designer in here as well. There's an accountant who hot desks here. There's a couple of freelance journalists. So it's really open to anyone.
So the idea behind it seems to be it's an open space where anybody who needs power or internet connection or even just simply a desk can go. Is that right, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. With Tech Hub, what we're doing is more than just creating those services, as essential as they are. The really important thing is engendering that sense of community, is bringing people together to collaborate, to talk to each other, to work together, to find out new things, share ideas, find their next CTO, find their next investor, find their next biz dev manager.
This really is a phenomenon that's been growing and growing in the tech community. Andy, I know that you've said that that Citizen Space in San Francisco was a real inspiration for you. Can you tell me a bit about why and what Citizen Space is?
Citizen Space is it's a co-working space in San Francisco, and I kind of got the ball rolling on this stuff. And we've really taken a lot of inspiration from it because not only are they providing this kind of basic facilities and stuff, but the whole kind of community feel and everything that's going on around Citizen Space is something that we're trying to reflect here as well. So Core, just like Citizen Space, we attempt to put on a lot of events for the tech community here. We have like hacker meetups and even kind of slightly sadder, more informal stuff. Like we had a party for the launch of the iPad and that kind of thing. And it's just about trying to like get everybody together.
Elizabeth, surely there's a lot of these spaces already in London. What gaps are you trying to fill?
There are a lot of clusters forming of small technology companies. And we've seen this happen before, that sometimes when there's an economic downturn and that sort of thing, if these companies aren't getting the right support, if they're not getting the right services, then they can dissipate. And so what we're really trying to do with Tech Hub is to keep that momentum going, to give them the right support to access services as well as each other. And there are co-working facilities around London and elsewhere, but right now we're really focusing very much on the Old Street area, on Silicon Roundabout, as it's been called, because there's such a cluster forming there. But there's no large space where everyone can sort of get together that they can say, right, that is the hub. That's where I can go to find other people easily.
Bobby, over in San Francisco, being closer to Citizen Space and a lot of these tech establishments, what can you tell us about how they work on the ground from your point of view?
Well, I think the interesting thing that's happened here, so you know, we're probably 5 years into the co-working experiment in San Francisco, and what you see emerging here, because there's a larger volume of these spaces, is really that that sense of what makes them different from just shared offices or those kind of utilitarian office spaces where everyone can go and rent a desk. So what we have is really communities of interest that form around specific workspaces. So we've mentioned Citizen Space, that's good for sort of designers and things like that. Last week's show, we were talking to social entrepreneurs. A lot of them share a space. In fact, some of the ones we spoke to share a space in the centre of town, specifically for kind of socially aware startups and businesses and freelancers. And I think that's a really interesting aspect is you can bring together people who have a lot in common, and therefore the ideas that they can share, and, you know, hanging around with each other isn't just a way to sort of break the monotony of working from home on your own. It's also a way to foster ideas and development.
Well, one of the Twitterers who responded to our call for questions earlier, Claire Redd, emphasizes that actually, Bobby. Claire Redd says that co-location tech companies include academics and artists. The results are better research, ideas, and this particular individual seems to have leveraged over £1 million in business in 2 years. So, you know, Andy, there are clear wins, if you want to use the parlance, for people who are involved in these spaces. Have you witnessed any of these collaborations? Have you witnessed anything that's come out of this that's really benefited the companies?
Most of us at some point have worked with each other on at least one thing. So I'm a designer. I've been working with some of the other developers here. There's a girl who's trying to launch her own startup at the moment, and we've all been like giving her advice and trying to help her with her kind of business plan and that kind of stuff. A lot of us have worked together in that we've provided advice that has then gone on to reshape how we do work and how we operate our own businesses. But then it's gone as far as actually, you know, physically working together. And that's what, you know, spaces like Core and other co-working spaces are good for, because all of this stuff just kind of happens naturally.
What's really interesting, Andy, is that I understand that you built Core out of a passion. Ultimately, it was something that you needed because you wanted to stop you know, hanging out in coffee shops and spending all your money on too much caffeine. Whereas Elizabeth, Tech Hub is a business model. You guys, you're trying to make money out of this. Is this a new approach?
It's a bit of both. Really, it's predominantly born out of the need, out of people saying, yeah, I'm sick of shuffling around Starbucks, looking, you know, waiting for the seat that's next to the PowerPoint. And people have been saying, we need this to happen. We need something like this in such an important area for the tech community as London. And so while it is a business, really, very much the community and the community's needs are coming first, and we're evidencing that by keeping our costs very low. We know that London rents and London services are very expensive for startups, particularly for startups from outside the UK.
How you guys are all coping with the fact that we're in a recession now? Because it's a kind of double-edged sword for co-working spaces, because A, there are probably a lot more people who are out of work and trying to do stuff, but also they're obviously much more aware of their costs, and probably a lot of them are turned off co-working because they think, you know, it's cheaper for me to work from home or just to nip to the coffee shop every now and then or whatever. How are you guys coping with that?
I don't know. Well, first off, I thought we were finished with the recession. I thought we'd had enough of it already. certainly, I mean, it hasn't really been that much of an issue, touch wood and all that, but I mean we had a bar camp here last year where there was about 300-350 people at it, and one of the points that was actually made whenever we were leaving was that no one actually mentioned the word recession over the course of the entire day. And I don't know if this is something that's maybe unique to Belfast, but it didn't really seem to affect anybody in that bad a way. Certainly there's plenty of examples of people who lost their jobs or had to leave their jobs for whatever reason and have started their own businesses. And they've even had enough time now to kind of do the whole coffee shop thing, work from home for a while, realize that it's unbelievably distracting and quite irritating generally, and to move into places like this.
Well, if you find yourself in Belfast or in London and are in need of some power, then you can head to Core or Tech Hub. There's also a strong network of co-working projects throughout the UK. Head on over to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for details. This week on our social media universe, people have been suggesting some, well, pretty unattainable people that you'd like us to bring on the programme. My personal favorites include Steve Jobs, thank you very much, J. McCormick. Mark Shuttleworth, actually, that's quite a good one. He's a founder of Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu, the open source operating system, and that comes from Scouser 73 Ubuntu, unsurprisingly. There's a clue in the title there. Roy Ascott, for his visionary philosophies on the telematic embrace, a social networking facility in the 1980s. Bobby, have you ever heard of Telematic Embrace?
I think I must have been in short trousers.
Oh, don't do that.
I'm like 12 years old. I don't remember any of this stuff.
I'm ignoring your youth.
Can't you pull some strings? I mean, you're incredibly well connected these days to all of these bigwigs that you've interviewed for the BBC. Bring some of them in.
Well, ironically, my favorite tweets from the redundant pile are from people saying Charlie Budd and Malay Geezer are my two favorites, who say, "Oh, that Alex Kratosky seems to know quite a bit. Why don't you interview her?" That would just be such a reciprocal interview. Thank you very much. That was producer Scott.
I would just point out, though, we did a few years ago when I interviewed Steve Jobs, I then told them that I planned on putting the audio out, and they absolutely went apoplectic. I expected them to turn up at my door and sort of smash up my voice recorder, because they were not happy with the idea. So even if we got Jobs, I don't think they'd let us broadcast it.
Well, then I will take him off the list, shall I?
Yes, and no Christmas cards either.
That's it for this week. Many thanks to our guests, Elizabeth Varley in the studio, Annie McMillan down the line in Belfast, and John von Techner, who chatted with Charles. Thanks as well to our pod team, Bobby Johnson in San Francisco, and producer Scott in the glass box in the big studio. Next week, we're playing silly games at the San Francisco Musée de Mécanique. Oui, oui. Pleasingly old school. Listen up next Tuesday. I'm Alex Kratowski. Thanks for listening.